Are you a self-help junkie? Do you believe there's 97% of your brain you're not using, and someone's going to tell you how? Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. It's a popular claim in the self-help industry, and there's no lack of courses, strategies, and gurus that promise to empower you and make you a happier person.
In the next hour, we will take you with us into another world, into the world of music, spirit, and meditation.
Today we hear from a skeptic, Steve Salerno, who's taken a close look at the self-help and actualization movement, dubbed SHAM for short. He's found that it's bigger than Ben-Hur, and it's banking on keeping you unhappy.
Very slowly, let the rhythm be your guiding light.
Whatever your views on it, the Believe It, Achieve It culture is everywhere. It's even prompted a one-woman show called Between Heaven and Earth by Stace Callahan. One of her many characters is Guru Frank, the host of a reality TV show called Boot Camp for the Soul. Here, Guru Frank's priming the participants.
Let's get something straight. This is called a boot camp for a reason. I'm not here to make you happy or to make you feel good about your lowercase self. And I'm certainly not here to stroke your ego. You know what ego stands for? Everybody's got one. So guess what? Yours isn't so special after all. Are you with me, people?
The guru will be coming back a little later in the show. The hyping of hope is how investigative reporter Steve Salerno characterizes the self-help movement. He's speaking to me from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Turn off the light. Take a deep breath and relax.
Steve Salerno, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
Steve, your book, SHAM, stands for Self-Help and Actualization Movement, which is a really nifty title, because it certainly suggests that there's a bit of SHAM going on in the self-help movement. But what is SHAM? I mean, how would you define its parameters? What does it encompass?
Well, first of all, the title was really ready-made. It's very rare that an author gets something handed to him or her on a platter like that, because that is the label by which a lot of people within the movement refer to themselves, that they're part of the self-help and actualization movement. And it's kind of one of life's delicious ironies that it resolves to the word SHAM. So, you know, you can't resist something like that when it's given to you. But I would say what I focused on the book, because I've had people say to me, you know, anything can constitute self-help. You could go out and buy yourself a Corvette, and that's a form of self-help because it makes you feel better. What I tried to focus on in the book were the things that really are not connected up to anything specific. So in other words, these are attempts to really just get inside your head and fix, supposedly, your thought processes. So there's no products involved. In fact, I've been asked about that a number of times. How come you're not talking about any of the fitness products that you see being sold via infomercial or whatever? Because my focus was primarily on the intangible aspects, because it's in the intangible realm. You know, obviously, if there's no specific product and if there's no way to measure how well you do with this supposed product that they're selling you, that's an area that's ripe for fraud. And my premise going into the book was, look, they make all these wonderful promises. They make all these claims. What can we actually prove? What can they document that they've been able to do for people? And that's where it breaks down. You have a $10 billion movement now just in North America where nobody holds its feet to the fire in terms of what are you actually doing for people? How different are they at the end than what they were in the beginning? So that was the premise of looking at the book. They say they're going to fix your head. Do they? How successful are they? And how much money do they extract from you in the process?
Isn't it one of the problems, though, of that whole self-help movement? And one could even extend it to psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, that evaluating how effective it is based so much on a subjective analysis or a subjective feeling.
Oh, there's no question. I interviewed a number of people highly regarded in the mainstream of psychotherapy for the book, and they were the first people to concede that even in a formal, clinical, one-on-one setting, the success rate is spotty, and it's hard to measure exactly what constitutes success. However, when you're dealing with formal psychotherapy, number one, you're dealing with people who have been trained, they're credentialed, they went through some sort of rigorous process that certifies them. When you're dealing with self-help gurus, in a lot of cases, they're promising these magical, transformative results. It's supposed to happen, you know, in the case of, say, Dr. Laura Schlesinger, in the case of 1 2-minute phone call, in the case of Dr. Phil, maybe a 15-minute segment on his show or one of his books. And a lot of these people aren't even credentialed in the first place to be delivering the kind of expertise that they're supposedly delivering. So I think that's a big distinction we have to make. Yes, all of the mental arts, so to speak, are chancy, but that makes it especially important that you know that you're dealing with somebody who at least has the expertise to be selling what they're selling.
When do you think the self-help movement really began? I sort of think of Norman Vincent Peale. Is he to be blamed for it?
Well, blame is a tough word. I mean, I've had people say we can go back to the almanac with Ben Franklin, you know, that any time that somebody was communicating wit and wisdom, that's a form of self-help. We had Norman Vincent Peale, we had Dale Carnegie, we had Napoleon Hill. But I think that the self-help movement was really pretty random and scattershot. You'd have books or gurus or tent evangelists that came along every so often. And then in the 60s, suddenly, we had this major cultural upheaval. A lot of people felt lost. Everybody was looking for something. Nobody could understand how the world all of a sudden got so out of control. And along comes this book. It was called I'm Okay, You're Okay. And despite the optimistic sounding title, the basic message of the book was you're not okay, that things happen to you very early in life that set the pattern for everything that happens to you thereafter, and that you're essentially trapped by that, that you, at that point, you become a victim of the sinister forces that are inflicted on you. And among those sinister forces were your parents, your family structure. That book really turned everything upside down that had been looked at as being a wholesome thing prior to that point, suddenly became a source of these major dysfunctions, these mental and emotional dysfunctions. And that book, which was a colossal blockbuster success, led to a succession of imitator books. It led to the codependency movement, which essentially argues that anytime you care about somebody else and make decisions in your life based on caring for somebody else, you're codependent and diseased. So I would say that's when the modern era began, and it was catalyzed by this thing that was going on in American society, at least, with the tremendous confusion over Vietnam.
Are you suggesting then that in the self-help movement there's a central irony, and that is that it cultivates a sense of victimhood, and in fact, you can be your own worst persecutor?
Hence the subtitle of the book, How the Self-Help Movement Made America Helpless. And I think as it was published in the UK, it was called How the Self-Help Movement Makes Us Helpless. But yeah, that's the bottom line, is that under the guise of fixing you, what it's really doing is implanting all of these deep-seated anxieties that make you think you're in much worse shape than you really are. And really, if the self-help movement has an unforgivable sin attached to it, it's that it took all of these basically normal things and it redefined them as dysfunctions, syndromes, diseases. So suddenly, you had a pretty much everyday life that had normal ups and downs. But the self-help movement taught everybody to be constantly taking the pulse of their happiness. Am I happy? Am I still happy? Am I happy 10 minutes later? And if I could just throw one other example at you, in this country, the U.S. certainly, women's magazines were supposed to be a wing of publishing that was just for women and was going to empower them. Well, Myrna Blythe, who was the editor of Ladies Home Journal here, which was, of course, one of the major women's magazines, she wrote a book a few years back called Spin Sisters. And she looked back at her own career as one of the, you know, the central figures in women's publishing. And she decided that they'd actually done more harm than good, because there was a time in the 50s when women certainly didn't have a lot of the opportunities that they have now, but they had more confidence about what they did do and what women's magazines have done. And remember, this is not me arguing this. This is Myrna Blythe, former editor of Ladies' Home Journal. The messages that they kept sending out to women, if you look at any magazine now, you're never thin enough. You don't know how to please a man. You don't know how to keep a man. You're always torn between your career and child raising. So under the guise of empowering women, we have this whole wing of publishing that really just has made women feel more confused and more inadequate every month that they open up the magazine.
One of the consequences of that is the dominant and pervasive message that I come across a lot, which is you can be whatever you want to be. Which in some ways is sort of obvious, but it's also outrageous because on the one hand, yes, you can be a good person and you could also possibly even be a bit thinner. But it's not likely that you're going to be able to be an Einstein or an astronaut. The amazing thing is though that a statement like that is so powerful. Is so alluring. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's the whole point. You can't sell a best-selling book on nuance. So for argument's sake, if I came out with a realistic self-help book, which is kind of like what you just said, the title might be, you can probably be better than you are, but who knows, you may fail anyway because maybe circumstances and the environment will undo you. You can't sell a book like that. The only way you can have a saleable book in today's publishing market is to imbue it with the extreme message. So instead of saying you can be better than you are, the message is you can be anything. And that's when self-help goes off the rails and into the realm of absurdity, because that's just, it's patently false. Under the guise, again, of empowering people by putting out these completely fallacious messages that have nothing to do with real life. I mean, you go into a school in the inner city, and you have an auditorium full of, let's say, 1,000 people, young children who have no advantages. They come from broken homes. They have tremendous dysfunction around them. And you have this audience of 1,000 children, and you're telling them you can all be president. It's patently ridiculous. You know, best case, maybe one of them might be able to go into politics. To tell people that they can do anything they want, to me, is more destructive than a more middle-of-the-road message, because it sets their sights so high, and then inevitably they're going to realize that it's all nonsense and they're in for a big crash.
Well, one of the key figures in the self-help and actualization movement is someone you already mentioned, Dr.
Right.
Laura of radio fame.
Right.
Now, Steve, to me, she's the epitome of what can go wrong when you believe I can be anything I want to be. Because she's kind of remade herself over a few times and has had some pretty embarrassing revelations. Can you tell her story?
Let's start with the fact that Dr. Laura is not a doctor in the sense that most people think she is. She's much closer to being a gym teacher than being a psychotherapist, because her degree is in kinesiology, which is muscle movement, which has very little to do with what she's preaching now. And yet the Washington Post, for a few years ago, for example, took this poll among their readers. How many people think that Dr. Laura is an actual doctor or at least a psychotherapist? And something like 70% assumed that she was. So that's, again, we go back to the issue of credentials. But in Dr. Laura, we have a woman who, at some point in her life, has broken just about all of the rules that she now establishes for her audience. By her own admission, she had a lot of issues with men and fidelity and relationships early on. There are very embarrassing pictures of her still on the internet as we speak. She came into her career completely by accident. She went out to Los Angeles to restart her life, called a radio talk show by a guy named Bill Balance, who at the time was, you know, a big icon in radio. And she was very entertaining. He kept her on the air for 20 minutes, which was unprecedented in radio. And eventually that led to her having her own show with a lot of sponsorship from him. But really, the point is that we have somebody in Dr. Laura who is not qualified technically to be doing what she does in the first place, who tries to solve people's problems in under a minute, who is very, very abrasive about it. You know, so you have somebody calling in. She doesn't even let them finish their spiel sometimes before she interrupts with these epical, life-changing suggestions. I mean, she'll tell people, leave your husband today, call the police on your children.
Oh,
these are things
dear.
That... No, seriously, if people actually follow the advice, it's frightening to think of the potential ramifications based on one phone call. The thing about Dr. Laura isn't so much the hypocrisy, because it's easy to point fingers at people and say, hey, you know, how can you tell me to do it? You didn't even do it. I think the one thing that Dr. Laura demonstrates, again, is that this is not a push-button science. The things that she expects supposedly her listeners to do in one phone call are things that it took her 30 years of life to evolve to. The bottom line, it's not that easy. And anybody who thinks that you're going to reach a new nirvana in life as a result of a phone call or a book is badly misguided, which is why the stuff never works, incidentally, and the same people keep buying the same books and making the same phone calls year after year after year.
Well, I guess Dr. Laura and others who are media personalities and in the self-help game demonstrate also the importance of showmanship. I mean, when I saw Deepak Chopra, for example, mm-hmm. address an audience of thousands, I was impressed by how alluring he could be for hours right. on end and how powerful. So how important is showmanship in the self-help and actualization movement?
Since so much of it relies on the persona and the way you come across, showmanship is incredibly valuable. And it's unbelievable to me some of the stuff that they get away with in the course of their showmanship. Tony Robbins, for example, who, if as I say in the book, if self-help were a religion, Tony Robbins would be its pope, because I don't think that there's anybody who has the standing in the movement that he has as being one of its philosophical gurus. But he has a moment on stage during his seminars, which incidentally can set you back a quick 10 grand. You know, we're not just talking about a $25 book anymore. We're talking about committing substantial amounts of money to somebody like Tony Robbins. He has a moment on stage where he'll call up somebody from the audience. This is supposedly at random. And he'll say, Tony's a big guy. He'll say, I'm going to lift you up. And he lifts the guy up. Then he'll say, now I want you to imagine that you are anchored to the ground and you are riveted and you can't be moved. And this is supposedly to demonstrate the immense power of thinking. And so this person goes into this supposed trance-like state where he imagines he's anchored to the stage, and suddenly Tony, despite his best efforts, can't lift the guy. Now, come on. I mean, that's like faith healing. But it goes over, and people applaud wildly, and what it demonstrates is what you said before, how badly people want to believe that you have very intelligent people making very good money who never in a million years would believe the kind of stuff that they see on stage if it occurred in their business life or in their personal life, but because they're paying this money to go to a seminar, to have somebody tell them you can do anything you set your mind to, they believe it, even though it doesn't work. And nothing's really happening. Their life is staying the same in the background.
It's a $10 billion industry in the U.S. alone. Steve Salerno will be back to reveal more of his research into the self-help and actualization movement, which, as you know, is pretty pervasive in the corporate world.
In the next hour, we will take you with us into another world.
You're with The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn. Later on, Steve will be talking about reality TV shows as part of the whole you can be anything you want to be phenomenon. And that couldn't be more appropriate to Stace Callahan's dramatic parody of the in-your-face guru of transformation. Her one-woman stage performance, Between Heaven and Earth, features a reality TV show. Boot Camp for Your Soul is run by Guru Frank.
Let the rhythm be your guiding light.
Radio National's Donna McLaughlin went along to the show at the Brisbane Powerhouse and came face to face with Guru Frank.
Hi, and welcome to day one of Boot Camp for Your Soul. I'm your host, Alpha Zed. But you can call me Guru Frank, because that's exactly what I'm going to be with you this week. Before I find out why you're here, let me tell you why you're not here. You are not here to have a holiday. You're not here to find a new and improved spouse. And you are not here to win a lot of money on national television. Not that I haven't gone down that path. If you think this show would ace as reality TV, text Guru Frank Rocks to Channel 10 now. Which reminds me, there is no phone a friend at Boot Camp for Your Soul. The only cell you're going to have access to is a meditation cell. So, switch your lifeline off and switch your higher self on. Let's get something straight. This is called a boot camp for a reason. I'm not here to make you happy or to make you feel good about your lowercase self. And I'm certainly not here to stroke your ego. You know what ego stands for? Everybody's got one. So guess what? Yours isn't so special after all. Are you with me, people? What am I talking about when I say ego? I'm talking about your multiple personalities. The masks you put on because you're terrified to look in a mirror and see the truth of who you really are. I'm referring to your pain body, your limiting beliefs, and your emotional wounds, all of which you proudly wear like a badge of honor. I'm not interested in your ego and its limitations. Only one ego can fit in this room, and it isn't yours.
Stace, congratulations on your show. Tell me a little bit about the evolution of Guru Frank. Where did he come from?
He's always been within me, I think. From when I was about 13, 14, Dad would always hand me personal development books, but he was into, you know, making money. It was so that I would become rich rather than do what I'm doing, I suppose. And I remember listening to Zig Ziglar and just astounded by this American accent. And since then I've listened to quite a few tapes of, you know, Anthony Robbins and Caroline Miss, and I always have that first 15, 20 minutes of going, oh, this accent's going to drive me insane. I can't possibly listen to what they have to say. But something always just gets in, and from there, I suppose, Guru Frank was the last addition to this show. He wasn't in the first two incarnations, and he just started knocking on my door and harassing me and saying, I've got to be here. I've got to be in this show. They'll love me. They'll hate me, but they'll love me, you know. And I think it's the way that I could say all the things that I wanted to say, but do it in a way that's more accessible for an audience. Whether you know it or not, you and I have a sacred contract. You signed a deal before you were born to experience all that you can be. And here's where you start paying in sweat. Your soul has brought you here to fight the war on the terrorist within. And it's my job to facilitate that process. And the reason I'm so damn good at what I do and get paid the big bucks to do it is I don't give a rat's ass if you like me or not. So let's get something straight, people. I don't need your approval. I'm sure as hell not going to give you mine. Some processes we do here you'll love. Others will push your button so much you want to explode and take me out with you. My care factor? Zero. In 7 days, you are all gonna leave here transformed. The question is, how far are you willing to go? Are you with me, people?
Well, set the context for everyone who wasn't there at the show. Guru Frank is one of a number of characters. So where does Guru Frank fit in?
Guru Frank runs the show. He is the host. He wishes of a reality TV show that's all about a boot camp for your soul, but what the audience are coming into is an actual retreat setting. So the audience are as much a part of the retreat as he is. That's why there's all audience interaction stuff throughout the piece as well. And he kind of guides the Stace character through her confusion in her life over her career and, you know, what's happening, where she's headed, all of that. So he's a bit of a misguided new age guru, and I wouldn't necessarily want to take him as my own, but I think his heart's in the right place. You people are late! Lazy ass time eaters! Why have you come to Boot Camp for Your Soul? Listen up, people. What I'm about to say to you will blow the idea of who you think you are out of your split pea brain. Your thoughts create your reality. This is not just a pretty saying. Let's look at what's going on for Stace. Now, Stace has PMT. Poverty mentality triumphs. It's a fear, future events appearing real, which she says she's fine about. Fine, frustrated, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. And this makes her tired. She's tense, irritable, restless, and energetically drained. Why? Why? Because all the time she's trying to appear nice. She's got a negative, insincere, controlling ego. You think I'm making this up? You want to be right like Stace? Right. Really ignorant guys and girls hate therapy. So what's wrong with that? Wrong. We rarely own negative gripes. And that, my friends, is my cue. Guru. God, you really understand. I think people want to come to the theatre to be entertained, and so Guru Frank is definitely a part of that. And for me, the best way to facilitate transformation in a community or for an individual is through humour, to not take yourself so seriously, to not take life so seriously. So while Guru Frank is, spouting all of this wisdom and philosophy, he also has things like, he makes people put a straw through a potato, and he makes people smash pumpkins on stage, So he's enabling us to look at ourselves and to laugh at ourselves and to enjoy each moment as it is, and that's the highs and the lows. So for me, I think humour is the best way of making that happen through the dark nights of their souls, I suppose.
And that's been your experience, that humour has helped you to be transformed?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah. Whenever I'm stuck, it's because I'm taking myself seriously, and you just have to be able to. And I think having animals around you or children around you is a great way of remembering that as well, of just going, oh, look, this will be over in 2 minutes. Just get over it and start laughing. And that's why there's the 60 seconds of laughter meditation in the show as well, to remind people that, this is great. It actually gets your endorphins kicking in. Like, medically, it's a great thing to do. This is your final night, people. And this process is not for the faint-hearted. Are you ready to dig your own grave and lie in a makeshift coffin all night? Are you ready to contemplate your own death and face the dark night of your soul? Do you have what it takes?
I'm not sure if I do. That was Brisbane actress Stace Callaghan channeling Guru Frank, one of the many characters in her one-woman show, Between Heaven and Earth, recently staged at the Brisbane Powerhouse. I hope she brings it to a town near you. Thanks to Donna McLaughlin for bringing it to us on The Spirit of Things, here on ABC Radio National. And we're in the land of self-help. Who knows, the boot camp of the soul may be coming to a TV station near you, and why not? The televangelists have been doing it for years. The comparison is not so far-fetched. I'm back with Pennsylvania-based Steve Salerno, whose book SHAM stands for the Self-Help and Actualization Movement.
Since you mentioned religion, Tony mm-hmm. Robbins as the Pope of the self-help religion, I wonder really if there are some very strong parallels, and in fact whether, as you say, the post-Vietnam War generation is actually looking for a substitute religion.
I think that's a good point. The secularization of society, for example, Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I've taken a lot of hits, and I think this is close to my 200th radio show that I've done on this. It's for my viewpoints on Alcoholics Anonymous. But even AA, the original 12 steps were very emphatically linked to God, that you have to give yourself up to God, a higher power. And as time went by and as society moved away from hardcore religion, the higher power became more secular. It's like it's not specifically defined as God anymore. It's anything bigger than you, some sort of consciousness that is, you know, overarching you, and that's what you surrender your will to. So you're right. But the big difference between religion and self-help is that self-help is explicitly a business. It is an industry. Now, you can have people who say all sorts of cynical things about religion, too. But bottom line, religion, it's between you and God. It's a matter of faith. It doesn't have to involve money if you don't want it to. When you cross that line and get into the realm of something where people are asking you for significant sums of money, I think we have a right to say, you can't just tell me it's a mystery. You can't just tell me I have to believe. You have to show me some documented results. And that's where the movement breaks down, because they can't show you those results.
I guess, though, the higher the price, the greater the promise has to be. And I suppose once you've invested that much money, you do have to invest a lot of belief and hope and expectation in it.
Well, that's exactly right. And you see, we have this human thing about denial where nobody wants to admit that he or she is a sucker. Nobody wants to say, you know, gee, that $15,000 that I've spent on various forms of self-help in the last year or two was all money down the drain. So we have this mechanism where people will tell themselves that, okay, I didn't quite get it yet, but maybe the next seminar or maybe the next book. And really, this is another crime of self-help, is the recycling of content, where it's called repurposing in the industry. But what it really is, it's the gurus plagiarizing themselves. So they'll release essentially the same book with a different title. And this is this sort of uneasy covenant between the self-help guru and the self-help consumer, where everybody kind of knows that nothing miraculous is going to happen. But the bargain is, if you pay me X amount of dollars, I will give you another jolt of adrenaline or whatever it is next year when I give you my next book. And that's the way the bargain just keeps floating merrily along. And there is no end game to it. It's never ending, because built into the fabric of it is the fact that you need their next book.
Well, I guess there is no law against plagiarizing yourself, as long as there's a publisher willing to print your book and to distribute it.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, you know, let's look at the ethics of it, because I've had people say to me, well, what about Harry Potter? You know, there's a book where she keeps going back to the same characters, and she keeps basically the situations are the same. If you read one book, you've read two or three of them. But there's a difference when there's a promise that says, I'm going to fix you. If you had a rash on your arm and you went to a doctor and the doctor kept giving you the same diagnosis and the same cream or salve or whatever it is, and this went on for month after month after month, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to go to a new doctor or you're going to give up on it, you know, and you just learn to live with the rash. But in self-help, people don't do that. They keep going back essentially to the same doctor, getting the same prescription. Maybe it looks a little different. The packaging is a little different. Maybe it comes from another family member, like in Dr. Phil's case. You know, now he's got his son essentially writes all of his books, except they're for teens. His wife now, Robin, has a book out which is for women. And it's all the same material. It's just the same material over and over again, and you try to segment it as many ways as you can. And each time you get a brand new payday.
Now, Dr. Phil is Dr. Phil McGraw.
That's correct.
What is Dr. Phil's claim to fame?
Well, his famous book, I guess you'd say Self Matters, which was the breakthrough book. The interesting thing, you got to give the guy credit in the sense that he has the credentials to be doing what he's doing. He is a licensed psychotherapist. But he had burned out of the profession and essentially given up his private practice. He did an interview with CNN where he described himself as, I was the worst marital therapist in the history of the world, you know. And he admitted that he was not good at that end of the market, at dealing with people. Then he goes into jury consulting, develops this very, very successful jury consulting business. Oprah Winfrey was sued by the beef industry for libeling beef, if you can believe it, back in the mad cow scare the first time. So she's summoned down to Texas. She runs into Dr. Phil, who is, you know, her jury consultant. They hit it off. She decides to give him a slot on her show every Tuesday, Tuesdays with Dr. Phil. The slot is enormously popular. And suddenly the guy is a guru in his own right. And this is a man who gave up practice, you know, but now all of a sudden, because it's obviously profitable, he likes it better again. So he became a one-man industry by virtue of the fact that he connected with Oprah Winfrey at some point, which incidentally is very commonly the path to fame. You know, all roads go through Oprah.
Yeah, she has the Midas touch.
Yeah,
but,
she does.
When it comes to credentials, I think John Gray's has to be the most unusual. He's the one who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. But
right.
I think he led a celibate life there for a while as the personal assistant to Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
That's the crack up of it all, is that if you read some of his books, he's got one, Mars and Venus in the Bedroom. He will give you the most explicit, I mean, probably too explicit, advice about intimate matters between men and women. And this is a guy who was a celibate assistant to a monk for 10 years prior to that. But beyond that, he claims to have degrees, but they're very suspect. One is from a diploma mill that was later shut down by the state of California. This is provable, by the way. The other one is from the Maharishi University, which, you know, there's questions to be raised there. So, again, you have somebody who doesn't really have the bona fides to be doing what he's doing, who doesn't have the background to be doing what he's doing. And incidentally, his own marital history has been rather checkered. And his wife at one point was Barbara DeAngelis, the noted sex therapist who also wrote books on sex and marriage and all that. And she was divorced multiple times at the time that she was writing these books. So, you know, you have to wonder, how do these people get away with this stuff? I'm not saying that you have to lead an unblemished life. Lord knows, you know, we've all had our problems. But don't be telling people how they should run their life if you can't even keep your own house in order.
Well, Steve, have you always been on the other side of these shamsters, shall I call them that? Or did you have a personal involvement at one time?
Well, I was in my first career out of college. I was in sales and marketing for 10 years. I was pretty good at it. I got sent to a lot of seminars where I was trained in high-powered persuasive techniques, or what were presented that way in any case. So when I decided to be an impoverished writer instead of a very effective salesperson, I'd started writing about what I knew. And what I knew was sales and marketing. And you have to also realize that if you go back to the origins of when self-help really caught its wind in the seminar movement particularly, they took a lot of the techniques from sales and marketing and applied those to a mass audience. So
The root of Werner Erhard, wasn't it?
That's correct. Yeah. Well, that and a lot of stuff that he thought up on his own. I mean, you know, berating people and locking them in an airplane hangar and not letting them go to the bathroom for 18 hours. I mean, I don't know where you get that from, but supposedly that was going to break people's resistance down and allow them to become the blank slate that he needed for them to find the new higher consciousness. But the bottom line is, I started writing about people individually. I did one of the first national pieces about Tony Robbins when he was doing his fire walks back in the mid-80s. I started writing about the sports motivation movement, which is huge now, where you have corporations paying $2,000-$5,000 a minute to have motivators who are sports celebrities come in and, you know, pump up the troops. And it was a while before I kind of put it all together and realized this isn't just a lot of random stuff. This is the makings of an entire industry. And what put it in focus for me was I took a job at a major lifestyle publisher, Rodale. When I saw the inner workings of the things that we publish that were self-help in nature, I realized how derivative one book was from another. I realized that, you know, we did a survey, and this really crystallized everything for me. We did a survey that showed that our best customer for any given book was somebody who essentially had bought the same exact book within the previous 18 months. And what that said to me is, you know, self-help should help. And allegedly, if you put out a book that is effective at doing what it says it's going to do, they shouldn't need you again for that same topic 6, 8, 12 months later. Certainly, they shouldn't keep needing you time and time and time again. And I think that's when I started looking around and seeing that this was pretty much a pattern throughout the culture in self-help. And I said, well, how much money is this generating? And when I realized that we were talking, you know, in the $10 billion range, I said, it needs to be investigated, and hence the book.
You're tuned to ABC Radio National, and this is The Spirit of Things with my guest, Steve Salerno, who says the only real difference between the self-help reader and the self-help author is that one of them writes well enough to get a book deal.
Well, let's talk about the clientele, because what you've just suggested is that people go after empowerment, but they end up feeling quite inadequate, or they always need a top-up. So in your view, I mean, are you suggesting that empowerment is really disguised inadequacy?
Well, I don't know that it's disguised inadequacy, but I think that if you hitch your future and your thinking processes to the idea that you are omnipotent, that there's nothing you can't do. Do you get the show? Do you get American Idol over there or the British equivalent?
Steve, we do get American Idol, and we also have our own version, Australian Idol.
Okay. Well, you got more idols than we do then. But the bottom line is that show is a classic example of false empowerment, because you have these kids who throughout their whole lives have been told that they are wonderful singers. And some of them, frankly, stink. You know it, I know it, everybody knows it. They're the only people who don't know it, because mama's right there in the audience screaming and hollering, you're wonderful. Their friends always tell them they're wonderful. And they're shattered when they get to this objective evaluation and they learn that they don't have the talent. Now, that's a relatively benign example. But let's talk about the United States school system. Kids, particularly in the lower grades in the United States today, they major in one thing, self-esteem. That is what they mostly learn, is that they're supposed to feel good about themselves. And this is a movement that took root in American schools at about the same time that the self-help movement took off, where the educators decided that their primary mandate was to make kids feel good about themselves. And the theory was that if they feel good about themselves, that will spur them on to achievement. Well, we have perfect evidence in the fact that that did not happen. The National Association of Self-Esteem took a poll a few months back that showed that kids today really do feel pretty good about themselves in school. At the same time, the test scores and the objective measures are going down. What we've really succeeded in doing, to, you know, the bottom line, is we've disconnected a sense of self-worth from what you can actually do. So you have a lot of people who feel really good about substandard performance. And I don't think that's what self-esteem was intended to do. But the net effect is, if you're constantly patting people on the back and telling them they're wonderful, they're special, they can do anything, you've completely shattered true self-esteem in the name of false self-esteem.
Well, we have the same debates here in education.
But don't do it.
Learn from our mistakes. Well, we already do, unfortunately. Okay. And I think the results are pretty much the same.
But, you know, let me throw this in, that it's a funny thing, too. This is another perfect example of something that happens in the self-help movement. You think that self-esteem is good. You know, like we automatically think, well, it has to be a good thing to feel good about yourself. But it was untested. And the studies that they'd done more recently, and the particular spearhead of that, if anybody wants to look these up, is a fellow named Roy Baumeister. It shows that the highest levels of self-esteem are found in people like gang members, drug runners, and all sorts of people who get into trouble. And really, if you think about it, it makes sense. People who have a tremendous amount of self-confidence, they don't think that they have anything to learn. They don't think that they have to listen to others. They want to make their own rules. And yet we embraced this whole notion of self-esteem, and we need to pump people up with it without ever considering, what if we're wrong? We didn't know. We just did it because it sounded good, and a lot of self-help is like that.
Yeah, there really isn't a sense of limits, I think, is what you're saying there. And it makes me think about the purpose of religion and religious communities and religious teachings, which after all, tend to focus on bad behavior and the consequences of bad behavior and sort of inculcating a sense of care and commitment to others, which I guess is the big difference between the self-help movement and religious communities.
Well, the word codependency, which completely took over this culture about, say, in the late 80s, we were just flooded with codependency books. The basic notion of codependency is you've been too unselfish. And I can understand the reason for that, because this was a time when they were trying to give a lot of women in particular the courage to leave abusive marriages. So they wanted to instill them with a sense that if the guy says, hey, if you leave me, I'll commit suicide or whatever the case may be, that you can't let yourself be manipulated by that kind of emotional haranguing. But they made it way too broad. As I said before, they went the extreme route. And now it's to the point where you would think that the most codependent person who ever lived was Mother Teresa, because she was always doing for other people. They've taken self-sacrifice and made it into a dirty word.
Steve, I guess in this world, whether we have religion or not, people are still looking for guidance. You know, sometimes people really do need not only encouragement, but also a few tips on how to behave. I mean, are there any good stories that you came across in your investigation of the self-help and actualization movement?
Of course. I mean, one criticism that I get fairly often when I do a show, is especially a call-in show, is that people will call in and scream at me, how can you be against progress? How can you be against personal growth? I'm not against any of that. I want legitimate personal growth. And it's like even Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very hard on AA in the book. But still, they have a base of about 2.2 million members worldwide. So even if their statistics of cure rates are horribly inflated, which I believe they are, I believe personally it may be as low as 10% of the overall pool of people who go, possibly even lower. But even at that, 10% of 2.2 million is still a body of 220,000 people. So there are people being helped. I'm just saying, prove it. Show us the real statistics. Give us the real stories. Don't fight other methods. It boggles my mind that when you're dealing with a problem that is a worldwide catastrophe like alcoholism, that they will actually oppose the newer chemical interventions that show real progress just because it's not their way of doing it. And their way of doing it was founded by basically a rectal surgeon and a wire rope salesman. They sat down together and they decided, we're going to make up, you know, our own little way of doing it, again, like self-esteem, based on nothing. There was no groundwork for that, no clinical data, no research. They just pulled this stuff out of a hat, and now it's a 2.2 million member organization. So, yes, there are some people who are going to be helped by Dr. Laura. There are some people who are going to be helped by Dr. Phil, but we don't know the percentages. And my own inclination, based on everything I've been able to find out, is that the percentages are very, very small.
Well, Steve Salerno,
thank you very much.
It's been a really fascinating study. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me.
Well, the next time you reach for the latest title from the self-help bookshelf, maybe you'll have second thoughts. My guest this week was Steve Salerno, who was speaking to me from his hometown in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. His book is Sham, How the Gurus of the Self-Help Movement Make Us Helpless. I know I'm in for an avalanche of emails singing the praises of Tony Robbins, Marianne Williamson, and the rest. Well, maybe Tony Robbins will accept our invitation to come onto the program sometime. But so far, he's been too busy. This week's program is available as an MP3 download. Just go to our website at abc.net.au/religion and choose the Spirit of Things. And while you're there, you can access transcripts of all programs. And for this one, check later in the week. The Spirit of Things is produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt.